don't understand solvent effects in any quantitative way. And eventually, a piece of physical organic chemistry is going to surface where one can calculate solvent effects properly, and incidentally go back and do over again the stuff that Kirkwood and I did at a proper level where one incorporates at least the first shell of solvent molecules, specifically as individual molecules that have specific orientations and activation energies for turning, and it'll be a much more complicated picture. But there are people who are at work on that now. The people who are at work on that now intend to do the whole thing on a quantum mechanical level, and it may turn out that what one will do is rework what Kirkwood and I did with three shells instead of two, a molecule, a first shell of solvent molecules, and a continuum. Even though my physical chemical friends tell me they're going to do the whole thing all out in quantum mechanics, I don't know if that is going to be true. But there's a big piece of physical organic chemistry there. On the subject of enzymes, I've already said that I don't think one understands enzymes until one can make a catalyst designed to do a particular job and show that it, in fact, does it. A number of people, Karpus here, are trying to apply molecular mechanics to proteins. Chiraga is trying a different kind of stunt. The proteins constitute an enormous challenge. It's going to be very difficult. And maybe eventually that can be worked through. In recent accomplishments in physical organic chemistry, certainly the most prominent one, are the Woodward-Hofmann rules, which constitute a real generalization in physical organic chemistry, and by no means a dotting of I's and crossing of T's. An accomplishment in physical organic chemistry that I perhaps cannot see in perspective because I'm too close to it was the work we did on showing that pseudorotation accompanies the hydrolysis of phosphate esters. I don't know if you know that work.
I know some of it, yes. In fact, would you say a little bit about the phosphate work?
Yes, indeed. I may have to adjourn for a few minutes.
Okay.
I'm getting.
Okay.
I was going to say something about pseudorotation, but that's.
All right. No, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the phosphorus one. Maybe just how it began, and then you can say something about the pseudorotation result.
Is it running?
Yes.
I didn't know.
Okay.
Well, the phosphate work actually began all the way back at the University of Chicago. the first paper was done there. It was a paper with Walter Pritchard. And we eventually came up with the idea of monomeric metaphosphate as an intermediate in hydrolysis of phosphate esters. More or less simultaneously with the same concept from C.A. Bunton in Ingold's laboratory. In University of London. I can't quite say how the work began. It certainly was a result of considering intermediary metabolism and looking at all those phosphates and thinking about all the physical organic chemistry that had gone into hydrolysis of carboxylic acid esters and amides. And here were these phosphates, which are much more complicated because phosphoric acid is a tribasic acid with very different relationships for the hydrolysis of the first, second, and third ester groups, dominated by the negative charges that you get when you ionize, when you hydrolyze and therefore ionize one or more of the groups. Certainly one of the stimuli to interest in this field was the perfectly marvelous set of lectures which Alex Todd gave at the University of Chicago related to his own syntheses in the nucleotide field. I can't remember what year those lectures were at Chicago. One could, I'm sure, find out, and I don't remember. I would guess that they were 48, 49, something like that. And although they were concerned with synthesis and not mechanism, they stimulated or crystallized or enhanced, as the year may be, and I don't remember, my interest in doing something with physical organic chemistry of phosphate esters. But of course, once one has formulated the statement in roughly the form I've just given it, namely that there are these compounds that dominate intermediary metabolism, and yet very little physical organic chemistry has been done on the system, one has a compelling reason to keep on pushing forward with that system, or set of systems. Now the siderotation business was really quite interesting from a sort of psychological point of view. The idea of pseudorotation in phosphorus compounds came out of Steve Berry's considerations of the NMR spectrum of PFI. If I'm saying things you don't want to listen to, stop me. PF5 shows a doublet in its F19 NMR spectrum with the signal split by the phosphorus. But that implies that all five fluorine atoms are equivalent, and there is, of course, no way in which you can have any figure with 5 points on it where all of them are equivalent. And if you have any sort of regular structure, it must either be a trigonal bipyramid or a square pyramid. So at best, 4, and probably only 3 fluorines can be equivalent. And IR spectroscopy and electron refraction has led to the fairly firm conclusion that PF5 is a trigonal bipyramid. So under those circumstances, there ought to have been 2 different phosphorus signals, with each one split not only by the... Did I say phosphorus signals?
Yeah.
Fluorine signals. With 2 different fluorine signals.
Yes.
With each of the signals split by the other fluorine atoms as well as by the 31 fluorine atoms. And Steve Berry had suggested the pseudorotation mechanism for this, which is the beginning of one of the normal vibrations of the trigonal bipyramid, and just continue through a square pyramid and out by a procedure that I think you know. And we, of course, knew about that work in these laboratories, and Ed Dennis had, as a matter of fact, given one of the physical organic seminars on the work that Schmutzler and Woodrichs had done at DuPont, expanding on Berry's work. So we have been looking at the rate of hydrolysis of ethylene phosphate and of its of methylethylene phosphate, the corresponding triester in these labs, stimulated by a knowledge of the action of the enzyme ribonuclease. Ribonuclease forms and then hydrolyzes the cyclic phosphate. That cyclic phosphate, related to action of ribonuclease, had been synthesized in Todd's laboratory by Brown, Dan Brown, and the fact that it hydrolyzed rapidly had previously been established. When we looked at ethylene phosphate and methylethylene phosphate, we were seeing whether it was the 5-membered ring or whether it had something to do with the pyrimidine base or what it was that caused this rapid reaction. We had come to the conclusion, which has later been verified properly, that a large part of it at least stems from steric strain, and had gone off in an almost mindless extension of this to look at the rates for the corresponding phosphonate ester. And then when Paul Hockey had discovered the oxygen 18 exchange into ethylene phosphate during its hydrolysis, we were faced with a terrible dilemma with respect to this strain theory, because one can understand easily strain accelerating the breaking of the ring, but how was strain to accelerate a reaction of exchange in which the ring didn't break? Well, we looked at also at methyl ethylene phosphate and found that that underwent hydrolysis in part to ethylene phosphate, where the methanol came off and the ring didn't break. And then we examined the five-membered ring, which is a phosphinate and has only carbon to phosphorus bond. And since the external methyl group comes off very rapidly from methyl ethylene phosphate, because of the strain, however it works, we expected it to do so here too. And it didn't. And I went into a panic. I decided that there was no real explanation for that. And the only explanation was that Paul Hockey's work was normal. Carefully as he had been, but his work was normal. There was no exchange. We had fooled ourselves. We hadn't used oxygen 18 water with a very high oxygen 18 content. Looking back over it, the work hadn't been done as well as it could be. And it was wrong. Now, it was harder to explain how we had made a mistake with the methyl ethylene phosphate work, but I worked out a way in which that was wrong. And I just decided we just must have made mistakes. We had published all this stuff. It was all garbage. We had fouled the literature with nonsense. I mentally wrote out my retraction, but before I wrote the retraction, I thought it might be a good idea to check it. So we went back and checked it in the most elaborate way. And I took everybody in the laboratory, made everybody work on this problem. Wachiro Tagaki, who was doing work on acetoacetate decarboxylase, went back and did Hockey's work over again, and we did it right. To begin with, we used oxygen 18 water with a great deal more oxygen 18 in it, so the effects would be much larger. Then, one of the ways in which we could have fouled up was by having some hydrolysis pump that carried oxygen 18 with it in our recrystallized ethylene phosphate. So this time, after we isolated the ethylene phosphate, we added the possible impurity without oxygen 18 in it, and then recrystallized the ethylene phosphate, barium ethylene phosphate, back to purity. So if there was any impurity in it, we would have diluted out the O18. And we also converted the stuff into an organic solvent, soluble salt, and recrystallized it from the organic solvent and brought it back. And worked all this out. We worked it all through. And of course, the oxygen 18 was in there, and it was in there in exactly the amount that you would gather from Hockey's work, and there was no question that Hockey's work had been absolutely right from the beginning. And at the same time, we checked the methyl ethylene phosphate by an entirely different method involving NMR spectroscopy, and that checked out, and it was absolutely right. So the psychologically interesting thing is that up to the time this work was checked, I had no idea what explanation could possibly be up for this discrepancy we had. And literally the day I heaved a sigh of relief and knew that we had got it right in the first place, I knew what the explanation was. It's clear that I must have known all along, but been unwilling to let myself off the hook, so to speak, by explaining the result until I was sure that they were right. And then we we check that out by making the prediction, which perhaps you know, on the methylphosphonate.
Not.
You might as well cut off that.
Okay.
Do you? I can give you a reprint that has this written out in it in nice. The that there have been a very large number of pieces of research since where either the products or the stereochemistry of reactions and phosphorus depend on this analysis. And the field has grown a great deal. There was also some NMR spectroscopy connected with this that was very interesting, and many people didn't believe any of this until the NMR spectroscopy came out. The NMR spectroscopy began in the following way. Do you want to listen to all this?
If you could talk about, aside from the fact that it sort of opened up the field and a good deal of research has resulted from it, what other impacts do you think?
I can tell you about one of the impacts it has not had. Naturally, I had hoped that some of the enzymic reactions at phosphorus involved in intermediary metabolism would involve this pseudorotation. It turns out that they do not, and that is fairly well established now. There has been a great deal of good to brilliant stereochemistry at phosphorus, begun first by Fritz Eckstein and David Usher. And Lord knows, I don't think Usher's name is on my list of postdoctorals, is it? If it isn't, it's a great mistake. Yes, there he is, and I didn't mention him before, who is a first-class scientist. Eckstein and Usher did the first work on this. There's been a great deal done since, including some marvelous work recently by Jeremy Knowles, some brilliant work by Mo Cleland, W.W. Cleland at the University of Wisconsin, and some nice work by Mildred Cohn, and they have all examined different enzymic processes, and they're now, I just wrote a review that had this in it, and I should know how many, but I think there are 8 examples. Perry Fry did some too. So 8 examples, or 9 examples, of enzymic reactions at phosphorus, and every single one of them proceeds with stereochemical inversion at phosphorus. Now, a single pseudorotation maintains is retention and not inversion, so that the inversions practically amount practically to a proof that there is no pseudorotation. And the enzymic processes presumably have evolved in such a way as to avoid the pseudorotation process. So one of the places this does not apply is in the biochemical examples, which are, to me at least, of primary interest. On the other hand, if you never had this work, you'd never know to ask the question.
That's right.
So that there is at least that little bit of consolation. Now, this same sort of thing is showing up all through inorganic chemistry. And I am too ignorant to know, too ignorant of the field of inorganic chemistry, to know To what extent this work had any impact or is having any impact in the field of inorganic chemistry? Someone else is there.
I guess we're still here. Any other areas where you think physical organic chemistry is going to go, or chemistry in general? That's a pretty big topic, and I don't want you. But I
sure. I think that there is a field of organic synthesis that is growing rapidly and beautifully at the moment. And this is the field of mixed chemical enzymic synthesis. Prize example of that at the moment is, of course, Corona's synthesis of a gene, where he makes big pieces of nucleic acid and then makes double helices and links two pieces together by an enzymic process. But if you look at the work that Arrigoni does and the work that Battersby does and the work that Cornforth does, you find the use of enzymic steps mixed with chemical steps. And George Whitesides at MIT is trying to incorporate Brian Kochalski's idea of immobilized enzymes to make enzymic columns over which you can pour things and take the products out at the bottom of the column. And I see I think he's got one example, and we'll get more. So I envision eventually an organic chemical laboratory that, in addition to the present equipment, has a set of columns. Oh, Mark. Esterase, and acetylating column, and so on, where you pour your reagents over the top of the column and take the product out of the bottom. And I envision lots of cases where people will have mixed syntheses, doing one reaction in sulfuric acid at 80 degrees centigrade and the next reaction in aqueous solution at pH 7.5 at room temperature using an enzyme or perhaps an immobilized enzyme so as to be able to get it out at the end of the reaction and to preserve the enzyme as you can when it's immobilized on a column so as not to not to have to prepare it again. Steve Benner, his name I mentioned before, has made some nitrilase, which is an enzyme that fibrillizes nitriles. And he is trying to persuade Woodward that this is the right way to hydrolyze nitriles rather than the ways that Woodward has done. The hydrolysis of nitriles doesn't go very readily. It takes fairly drastic conditions usually, and if you do it by the hydrogen peroxide method to produce the amide, followed by nitrous acid to destroy the amide, you can run into other problems. I think nitrilase is going to turn out to be a useful reagent in the organic chemical laboratory. And I envision enzymology as
entering into organic synthesis. And the organic chemists who feel somehow that it's cheating and that they shouldn't do it will be replaced by those who are anxious to make something and are willing to seize on any reagent in sight that will let them do it. So I really believe that that's going to be a big field of organic synthesis. Wow. It's being practiced today. I mean, there are half a dozen practitioners.
There's more and more of this marriage between organic chemistry and biology.
Yes.
Or biochemistry.
Yes.
That's the direction.
And of course, when you think about it, all the fermentation industries involve that. When John Gerlt and I wanted to do the heat of hydrolysis of phosphate esters, we look at this question of strain. We could hydrolyze ethylene phosphate rapidly in a calorimeter. But dimethyl phosphate doesn't hydrolyze worth a day. We have the rate of that in half time of a couple days in 2 normal sodium hydroxide at 110 degrees centigrade, which is not good condition for calorimetry. So we decided the only way to measure the heat was to get the rate up. The only way to get the rate up is to get a catalyst. The only sensible catalyst is an enzyme. So we went looking for an enzyme to hydrolyze phosphates and diesters. Well, there's special ones, of course, that hydrolyze nucleotide diesters, but if you want a general enzyme, we didn't have one. But Dick Wolfenden, whose name I couldn't remember last night, each other, had reported in the literature that he could grow Aerobacter on a diet containing